This is an interview with Pat Hitchcock, who served with the Red Cross Recreation Division during World War II. This interview is being conducted at Mount Horeb Public Library at the following address, 105 Perimeter Road, Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, on the following date, Saturday, September 20th, 2008, at 5:30 p.m., and the interviewer is Jessica Williams.
Well, you want me to tell you when I was born?
Yeah. If you want.
My birthday is November 10th, 1919. And I was born in Hartford, Connecticut. My hometown, I think of my hometown as being Somers, S-O-M-E-R-S, Somers, Connecticut. That's where I lived most of the time in Connecticut.
Okay.
When I was growing up in various places in Somers, what do you want me to, where do you want me to start? I don't want to get carried away with too much early background unless you...
That's okay.
It is?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
I think the more that you tell, the better.
Okay. Well, so I had marvelous parents. Parents that I probably didn't appreciate at the time, although I loved them very much, but I appreciate them now. Especially because I realized that they were very unusual. they never let me feel that there was nothing I could do because I was a girl. Mm-hmm. I could do anything. Mm-hmm. Gender didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Just interest and enthusiasm and health and so on. My father was, my grandfather made hand tools and had a family business, my father's father. My mother's father had a paper box mill in Montville, Connecticut. And Dad's home was Meriden. His father made hand tools, and so he'd always been in the tool business, interested in tools and carpenter's hand tools. And so there were some family difficulties, and my father left Connecticut and took us out to Ohio. And that was before the 1929. I remember living out there with my parents in Ohio and enjoying it a lot. My dad used to take me to football games because he was a quarterback himself and he loved football. He used to take me to the local college in Findlay, Ohio, mm-hmm. football games. And so and I got interested in that. And then my folks always took me to the circus. The circus came to town about 4 o'clock in the morning and Dad and I would get up and go to the circus. I was with my father a lot because my grandmother lived with us, mm-hmm. and she was a marvelous cook and didn't have much patience with me mm-hmm. and my sister, and so I didn't want to be with my mom and grandmother as much as I wanted to be with my dad. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he taught me a lot. I can remember parties in our home in Ohio when things before 1929. And I can incidentally remember walking to first grade and back, which was quite a walk, about a mile. And I can remember coming home. And on my way home, this little old lady would come up in her electric car and ask me if I would like to ride home, if she could take me home. And I just say that because that was, that would be about 1925, 26, they had electric cars. It was this beautiful, great, big black car. It was, and it, you know, totally silent. You couldn't hear it coming. And I always felt like a queen when I climbed up in there and got a ride home. Then the crash came in 1929, and it affected my family a lot. My mother had never done any physical work, and I don't know that my dad had either. In a way, I mean, of course, he worked in the factory, in a tool factory, for my grandfather, and but to shorten it up a little bit, we went back to Connecticut, and my dad got a farm. Because he wanted to do it because of his health and my mother's health. And very fortunately, these things happened just about the time when suddenly there wasn't any money at all, hardly. And so at least we had a farm. Mm-hmm. And I had a mother who, as I say, was... she went to a finishing school. She was... brought up as a quotes lady. My grandmother, she wanted to be a dancer, and my grandmother thought that wasn't proper for a young lady, so she was disappointed in not being able to continue ballet, which was she really intended to be. Well, anyway, this little frail kind of ballerina type woman ended up raising 500 chickens, doing a whole vegetable garden, a complete vegetable garden, living on the farm, going out with me. We went out to pick blueberries, wild blueberries, the little ones, and she and I would walk down to the village, this is in Somers, Connecticut, we'd walk down to the village with two buckets of blueberries each and sell them door to door, and she did all kinds of things to help us get through the Depression. She made. She got a marble slab and learned how to make candy, and learned how to make chocolates. And so that she would put. She and my grandmother put those up, and they would sell. And they also had, they had at the farm. We had a dining room and a parlor, sort of. And they had tables in there, and they had meals on weekends for people from the city who would come out and wanted to eat country meals. And of course, as I say, my grandmother was a marvelous cook. And so my job, my dad would load the car with little tools that he made in the barn and would package them. And he'd say, okay, Pat, you have to take care of things now here at home. I'm going to be gone. I'll sleep in the car. I'll be back when I've sold everything out of the car. And so then my job was on a Thursday night to kill about 8 chickens and 3 ducks and clean them and then take them up to Grandma and Mother, and they did the rest. And then I had to also make ice cream by hand, rolling it around. And delicious ice cream my grandma made, and pies, and they made all kinds of things. Anyway, they had wonderful meals, and they had a good little business from people in the city who would come out to the country. Mm-hmm. And our farm was quite isolated, so it was a pretty place, and people enjoyed it. And we had chicken Thursday night, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday we would have leftovers, and then we had leftover chicken. I got so chicken. Anyway, those were great years. I had to do the wood, split the wood, and get it into the cellar, and we had wood fires and. My grandmother cooked on a wood stove, and that was the Depression days.
Was it just you and your sister, or did you have other siblings?
No, I had just a younger sister. She was 6 years younger than I was. Yeah. Actually, I had an older sister, 2 years older than I, who died when she was 6, with melanoma. She had a growth in her back, which was so unusual for children to have that doctors came from all over to Detroit to see her. Of course, in those days, they didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. But so there's just my sister and me mm-hmm. at the farm. And then my folks knew that I would have to. They looked ahead and they knew that if I stayed in Connecticut in summers, that I would be in three different high schools in 4 years, because summers didn't have a high school, so they bused kids to this one high school, and then the next year they bused them to a different school. And although my parents didn't know they were going to do that, that's what I would have had. So they wanted me to go to a boarding school mm-hmm. where I would have 4 years, and they knew that I would have a very good education. So they sent me for $350. I went the first year to Northfield, which was a girls' school. Mm-hmm. There was a boys' school attached to it, Mount Hermon. It was 5 miles away, but these schools are still going now today. And this was Northfield School for Girls, they called it at the time. And after that, I was able to earn all the rest of it myself by being by living in a freshman dorm mm-hmm. and being a student counselor sort of thing. And so I got a really remarkable opportunity there and had a lot of wonderful things happen. And so then after Northfield, I wanted to go to the University of Wyoming, because I was very interested in horses and wanted to go to, they had a dude ranching course. Mm-hmm. And so I went out to the University of Wyoming on the train all by myself. And I got scholarships and I worked. And I found that after the first year, it was really hard. I was missing a lot of what I was there for, because when they'd go on field trips, I'd have to work. Mm-hmm. So I decided that wasn't a very smart thing to do, that I should go get out of school and go to work and earn the money and then go back to school, mm-hmm. which I did. And I worked in an aircraft factory. Then the war was on, 42. 43, mm-hmm. and 44, and then I wanted very much to go in the Red Cross, and I found after I'd gotten out of the University of Wyoming and was working, I found that I couldn't get in the Red Cross unless I had a college degree. Why they needed college degree people to hand out coffee and donuts, I don't know, but that's the group I wanted to be in, the Clubmobile. That was kind of the glamour outfit of the Red Cross, the mm-hmm. Clubmobile. Okay. We drove big 6x6s, I can show you a picture, big huge trucks that had coffee machines in them, two of them, and then donuts. They made donuts too. Mm-hmm. And although when I got to using one overseas, the French girls made donuts for us, so I never got into the donut making business. But anyway, I had to go to college, and they took people who had been in entertainment. There were a lot of Hollywood people in the Red Cross women, and then there was, then they wanted people who'd had some kind of recreation experience. Mm-hmm. In those days, they didn't have any recreation majors, mm-hmm. you know. But, so the only thing I thought I could get in, one way I could get in was to take physical education. Mm-hmm. And then I had to take a hard subject like sociology, or that wasn't very hard, but I mean English or history or something. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't really want to do that, but I couldn't find any majors. Mm-hmm. So I went to the University of Syracuse for one semester, and while I was there, I discovered there was a University of Massachusetts, that had an outdoor education major. Mm-hmm. And although outdoor education, I don't know if that would have counted it, but I thought, yes, it will. I mean, I'll make it count. It'll be recreation. Because it was both. It was party planning and all kinds of dance planning and all kinds of outdoor education and recreation. So I changed to the University of Massachusetts and was able to get through in 2.5 years, and actually 2 years, because they sped things up a lot then to get move you on. And so I graduated from this outdoor education program, which at the time I was really eager to become a ranger in a park, and I did that for a summer. But then I wanted to get into a national park. But then, well, the war was really pushing us, all of us. You know, we were all pretty much caught up in it. Although most of my friends, my men friends, were youth hostlers. And the youth hostel movement was just coming on then really hard before the war. And Monroe Smith, who was the founder in the United States. See, it was at Northfield, in the little town of Northfield, that was the first youth hostel, and that's where I was going to school. So my mom told me, called and said, "You should get over there and see what that's all about. That really, I know you'll be very interested in." Well, I did, and of course I was. And before I went in the summer, before I went in the Red Cross, or one of the summers, the first summer that I went to the University of Massachusetts. I went there for 3 weeks, and then I got a chance to take a 12,000-mile bicycle trip with a group of kids in the United States. We didn't bike all the way, of course, but we biked an awful lot of the way. We took the train, and a lot of times we went up north. We biked to Canada, and then we got on a car that was. It made into a youth hostel. You put your bikes in there. There was a little kitchen. There were bunks and so on. And so we lived there, and we went biking with youth hostlers from Ottawa, and then we'd go back to the bunkhouse, and then they'd put us on the siding, and then they'd take us. Canadian National Railway would take us out to the next stop. Let's see, what was it? It would have been. Let's see, it was Ottawa, and then oh, the capital of Quebec. What is it? Well, anyway, we went with them. And then we went on to Winnipeg, and we went on to Jasper. And at Jasper, they left us off, and we biked all the rest of the way through the Canadian Rockies and down, and around the United States and so on. Well, so I was very, very much interested in youth hostling, and would have gone into youth hostling professionally right then and there, but I did. I mean, there was no opportunity to do anything really. I mean, the Red Cross was still the most important thing for me. So when I got through, I graduated a month before my class, and they hurried me up, and I took a math test, I remember, to get through. And I got through, and went down to Washington for training. I would have loved to have. I thought a lot about wanting to be in the a pilot. You know, they had a women's pilot crew that was in the Air Force, and I really wanted to, so much to do that. But most of the women who were in that were women who had enough money to have already been trained and been flying a lot. And so I knew that wasn't a possibility for me. But anyway, the Red Cross was really a way of my getting overseas. And so I wanted very much to be part of this war. I mean, this was my generation's war. And we were all very, very involved. And of course, I mean, except, as I say, my friends who were, well, they were involved too, because my friends who were in youth hosteling, the men, had been hiking and climbing with Germans, youth hostlers, just the year before, in the Dolomites, and they weren't about to. In fact, two of the men who brought youth hostling to the United States were the Germans who they hiked with. And those boys were conscience objectors, of course, and then a lot of my own brother-in-law. And those boys, they had a struggle. I mean, they were put through all kinds of things. I mean, my brother-in-law was sent to a jaundice experiment, and they had to get jaundice, and then the government tried to see how they could, what they could do about it. But these conscientious objectors in World War II were much maligned and got no credit and no opportunities when they came out, They couldn't get jobs or anything because nobody had any kind of respect for them, which meant they really didn't understand what they'd been through and how loyal they were to their beliefs that they weren't going to kill people, I mean, just it was they went through incredible things. My brother-in-law was assigned to a mental institution in Vermont, and he happened to have a farm in Brattleboro where the mental institution was. So he kept his farm, used it for the boys, so that when they got 2 hours a day off of these were real snake pits in those days. I mean, if it hadn't been for the conscientious objectors, we would today maybe, although I would hope it would by now it would have gone, but we would have put people in ice water, we would have chained them to the wall, and they were doing all kinds of horrible things to mentally sick people, And the COs that said, no, we're not going to do that. I mean, there'd be like a group of 10 or 12 of them in one hospital, and they were the only ones that didn't have any other help because everybody was, out in the war, and so they had to let the boys experiment and do what they wanted to with them. And the boys, they taught people a lot about how to take care of, and lovingly take care of people, and how it wasn't anything that should have been treated the other way. So anyway, I got out of school and went down to Washington, and I was spent a month in training, and there was a big bunch of us, and we lived in GI quarters, and we had to learn. Actually, we were considered officers. We weren't supposed to fraternize with the GIs, but we were over there to serve the GIs. So that was really put us in a tough position, and some of us just didn't pay any attention to that. I mean, the GIs treated us like queens, especially, I mean, overseas, it was just amazing. I graduated May 1st, and I was to be on the Queen Mary, which was to go from New York to Southampton in the first run. See, the war was over the first, and they didn't know it was going to be over, I guess. I mean, it was over very unexpectedly. The German War, not the Japanese War, not the war in the Pacific, but the war in Europe was over May 1st. And on May 5th, they held the Queen up for 5 days. And so instead of going on to the Queen May 1st, I went up and graduated with my class. They were just graduating, and then I came down and went aboard the ship, and we went over. And what they were trying to do with the Queen Mary was to have it go for the first time and make some kind of a record go straight, because they had to go 6 minutes in one direction, and then they would have to turn another 6 minutes to avoid the submarines that took 7 minutes to set up. And so they hadn't gone across like that, and this was the first chance, and they wanted them to see how fast they could go and make a record. So, and they did. But So we were loaded with GIs. I got a lot of pictures in my slides. Not a lot, but I have some pictures in the slides showing thousands of men on Queen Mary and just a handful of girls. Yeah. And that's where we began to get spoiled right from the beginning. Then we went to, actually, we went to Ireland, to Dublin. Then we went down to London in the, we went down to London in the dark and at night. And London was still blacked out. We couldn't have any flashlights, and you couldn't smoke a cigarette or anything because the Germans were still lopping shells into London. You know, there were some units that just wouldn't quit, and we hadn't gotten to them yet. And so then we weren't in London very long. We were put on a ship to go across the North Sea. There were still mines floating in the water. And I remember not feeling really kind of uncomfortable down in the, we were down in the hold, you know. It took overnight for us to get to Le Havre. And Le Havre was a big port that had received a lot of troops and was still receiving various things. Things that hadn't been held back, lots of material, lots of jeeps and tanks and all that thing was still being dumped on in Le Havre. And so we got there, and then we went by train to Paris, and then we were in Paris for a week until we got our assignments. There was a large group of girls. I don't know, maybe 40 or so, 50 maybe. I don't know. The pictures show quite a few. And then we went. I was assigned to Marseille. Oh, well, while we were in Washington, we were trained to drive these big trucks. And we also had to learn all the protocol and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so then, when we got to Paris, we had a refresher course in truck driving. And then we got sent down to Marseille. And there in Marseille, our job was to take coffee and donuts. The Red Cross had discovered that the coffee and donuts were symbolic of home to the boys. And they, of course, so would have apple pie have been, and so on. But that you couldn't do make that. I mean, this was the easiest thing to do that would be quick and easy to dispense in a truck like this. And so they call these club mobiles, and we had record players, and we would drive out. We would load up with coffee and get the coffee made and get the donuts and load up with them, and then we had took barrels of donuts, and then drove out to staging areas where there were just miles of tents forever. And these were taking the boys out of Europe who'd been fighting and sending them to Japan because they didn't have enough points to go home. A lot of them had been in the Battle of the Bulge and had been through terrible times. And they didn't have enough points, and they'd read about Japan and what terrible things were going on over in the Pacific. And of course, the morale was just awful. I mean, I don't know how they took it, but they knew that that's what they had to do until they got enough points, and then they could go home. So we would drive out to these staging areas, and as soon as they'd hear the trucks coming, they would run and line up. Just miles of them with their canteens, and they just wanted to hear us speak Americanese. They wanted to hear English spoken by an American girl. They didn't want to hear a British accent. They didn't want to hear a French accent. They were, and so they really were great to us, and they'd come up. and with their canteens, you know, or where are you from, honey? I mean, that was always what they said. And then we'd tell them, and then they'd yell, somebody down the line would yell if you said you were from Texas. And we played the Yellow Rose of Texas was one great hit. Some of those other songs in those days were popular with the guys. And then they'd get their coffee and their donut, and they'd go way back to the end of the line, hoping that by the time that they would be able to get another one before we left. I hope we'd have some left by the time the line got through. Well, it rarely did, but anyway, and that was what we did in Marseille for quite a while, and then we were told to go down to the docks, take the trucks down to the docks, and take care of the boys that were going on a shipboard. And of course, that's where you really realized how terrible the situation was. I mean, the boys would tell you, "Oh dear, you know, I had to give up my dog, my pets," and they'd have their duffel bags with them, and they, you know, they always told you that you reminded them of their girlfriend or their wife or their mom or something. They were so appreciative. Well, one day down at the docks, there was a loudspeaker that was being used, and suddenly over the loudspeaker came this announcement: "Ladies and gentlemen, we wish to tell you that the President of the United States has signed an armistice agreement with the Japanese, and the war is over." Well, those boys didn't care whether they had any coffee and donuts. They just threw us up in the air, and oh, they were so happy. And out of their duffel bags came all these dogs and cats that we were feeling so sorry for them for, that they'd left behind, which they hadn't left behind. Big liars. And yeah, that was a great day. So after that, I stayed for a while, but then I thought, what am I doing? By then, that I'd been there a year. Not quite a year, maybe 10 months. No, because I was only there a year altogether. We were supposed to sign up for 2 years, but I must have been 6 months I was there in France. And then by then they had decided that they would take girls who had 2 years of college. And I thought, I spent all this time going to doing recreation, you know, getting a degree in recreation, and these girls can deliver the donuts and coffee, you know. I really should be doing something with that. And I didn't want to do club. Club, there were three groups of Red Cross girls. There was the club, and they did recreation in the cities, and then there was the Club Mobile, that was the one that I was in, and then there were hospitals. And I decided to I wanted very much to go to Germany. I would go into hospital there and have a craft shop. That's what I did. And you put on parties for the guys and the displaced persons. Polish girls would come to the parties, and the boys had a good time. And they came down to the craft shop, and they made things, and we played cards and did all kinds. We had a club in the hospital as well as the craft shop.
And that was in Germany?
In Germany. Yeah, that was in Karlsruhe.
Okay.
That was my first assignment. Well, when I got to Karlsruhe, you know, I didn't have any transportation, no club mobile, nothing. And I thought, gee, we got to have a jeep. We got to have some transportation. There were about 5 or 6 of us, and so I knew that. Oh, we got rations, by the way. Every GI got rations once a week at the PX. That was what they called the store, post-exchange, the PX. And your rations consisted of a bottle of cognac, a carton of cigarettes, sugar, butter, flour, all kinds of wonderful candy, you know, gosh, all kinds of great stuff. And so I knew that in Germany, I knew that I could, if I took my bottle of cognac to the master sergeant of the big area that contained all of these wheels, I mean, all kinds of trucks and jeeps and all the army stuff that they had there, you know, that they hadn't shipped out. And as you were driving along, you know, you'd see tanks in the woods, right? And you'd see on the Autobahn, there were no cars. The Germans couldn't drive. There was no gas for them at all. You'd see maybe an American car once in a while. I mean, American truck or a Jeep or something. But then once in a while, you'd see trucks loaded with people standing up in trucks. And these were displaced persons, these Polish and Russians and people that were being, not Russians, Polish and Lithuanians. And some of those people that were held by, used by the Germans to used as laborers, you know, they were released and they were living in Germany still. They didn't have any place to go, no way to get home. Until somebody came along with a truck and they loaded them up in there and they took them off. But so, and I can remember driving. Well, I got this. I'll tell you about getting the Jeep first. So I went to this master sergeant and I said, I had my uniform on and I was an American girl and there was no problem. All I had to do was, hey, you know, we need a Jeep. We don't have any transportation. Can you get us a Jeep? Well, he had thousands of Jeeps. Oh, honey, I will get you the best Jeep you ever saw. And I gave him my bottle of cognac. And he had a Jeep all painted up for us by the afternoon with American Red Cross on it. And it was really first class. And so I used that a lot, and the other girls did too. And we... I would go to Frankfurt sometimes on my day off to get stuff. And that was maybe, I don't know how many miles. I should check that out. But anyway, not too many. Maybe take me a couple of hours. And driving along the Autobahn, this airplane came down. They used to use them as
landing strips?
Yeah, landing strips. And as you drove along the Autobahn, you'd often see holes in the woods where they had planes. Planes were stuck there, and that's where they hid them. And it was hard to see with the trees, you know. And this little plane came down right in front of me, and I could see him coming. You know, so of course I stopped, and he stopped, and he jumped out, and he came. He had a cane in his hand, and he came running over, and he said, Red Cross girl, do you have a map? And I said, sure. I said, you know, I haven't got a map, and I don't know where I am. I'm lost. And we had a big party last night, and one of the guys had this lovely cane, and I'm taking it back to him, but he lives so and he was going to fly this cane all the way back to. I mean, this was the end of the war, and there was no organization at all, hardly. They didn't know what they were doing. In fact, one of the things, and I've thought about this so much since, including when I was there, I noticed that they weren't ready to occupy. Mm-hmm. They were still sending young men, 18, 17 and 18, over who were prepared to fight. And they would come over into Germany, and they got into all kinds of trouble, you know. Actually, the army said that they weren't allowed to fraternize with German girls. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that the boys who did fraternize, and of course, I mean, there were boys who did. Mm-hmm. They had a girlfriend, German girlfriend, and they would go to her home. They seemed to be the most stable. Mm-hmm. They seemed to be, they had something, place to take their PX rations, you know, and they could help his family, and mm-hmm. and they had to sweat out the time until they could go home. And so they seen the best of justice. Well, one time I was driving along the highway, and I ran, I noticed an American officer standing out on the Autobahn, holding out, trying to stop me. And of course, I was, you never loved anybody like that. I never couldn't imagine anybody his being in that situation. And I stopped, and he said his Jeep had just given out. He'd had trouble with it, and he wondered if I would take him into Frankfurt, if that's where I was going. And of course it was. I said, oh, sure. And come to find out, he was an interpreter. So, yeah, and I said, oh, okay, you drive. And so he drove. And then he asked me if it was okay if he went into this little village he was supposed to do, had one more job to do before he got back to Frankfurt, and he wondered if I minded if he did that. Of course not. So we drove up in the dusk into this little village. And it was kind of a dirt road, I remember. And our headlights were on. All of a sudden, this woman, German woman, came running out of a house, waving her hand and crying and yelling and screaming and asking us to stop. And oh boy, was I glad he was along. Well, of course, I wouldn't have been in that situation anyway, probably. But anyway, he got out and he went over to her to see what was the matter. And then this young kid, American GI, came running out of the house, brandishing a gun, swearing like everything. And he started coming over towards the Jeep, and he noticed me sitting there, and he stopped, and he threw his hands on the hood and threw his head down and said, oh, if I'd only known there was an American girl here, I would never have said what I said. I mean, yeah, I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, he was so upset that he swore in front of me. That's the way it was. Uh-huh. That he started to cry. Huh. And, of course, the officer was there, and fortunately, and straightened things out. I don't know, it was some kind of, he was drunk. Uh-huh. And that's what was happening. Mm-hmm. And after that incident, I decided then, what was I doing in Germany? I mean, all I was doing was reminding the guys of home, you know, mom and my girlfriend and, mm-hmm. Oh dear, here I am. And why can't I go home? And mm-hmm. So I decided then to apply to go home because I wanted to be in the American Youth Hostels. Mm-hmm. That was my Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. That was our Peace Corps then. I mean, we believed then that if you traveled with people from other countries, if you stayed in their homes, if you ate with them and slept in the same youth hostel with them, and so on, you'd never fight. You wouldn't. There wouldn't be war. So we thought, and this is the Second World War. You know, the First World War was the war to end wars. Well, we thought this was going to be the war to end wars, and this is how, and we were going to heal it by getting hostels everywhere and getting youth hostlers, people mixed up and everything. Well, another thing that really settled my leaving was the fact that they didn't know what to do with us. Mm-hmm. When the Japanese War was over, and I went into Germany, and I was in Karlsruhe for maybe 3 months. And then they closed the hospital. And then they sent us on rest and relief, okay? So we went to Garmisch, and we went to all kinds of, and we went to Switzerland. Well, they sent us We go back, and they sent us back to a hospital in Darmstadt, and that closed down in a week. So we were on another vacation. Mm-hmm. So the last 2 months, I really didn't do a lot of, but had a really enjoyable time. Got to know Germany, got to know Switzerland a lot. Went twice to Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Went to St. Moritz and went to another little place, and both they had turned a lot of the Swiss resorts into rest and relief places for the American GIs, mm-hmm. as well as all the Garmisch-Partenkirchen and Bavaria and parts of Germany where they could have. And what was interesting was that the German ski troopers were the teachers of the GIs. They taught skiing. And in my work in the hospital, I had a German PW. And they were marched in line in the morning. They had PW written on their back. They wore black suits. They were prisoners of war. And this he was assigned to me to work in the shop and to help me with shop things, you know, to do whatever I needed, lift, haul, whatever. And then at night, at 5 o'clock, he'd have to line up and go back. And I don't know how long that lasted. Well, it stopped when the hospital closed, but I don't know what happened to Fritz. I mean, I just don't know what happened to him. Mm-hmm. But he was really nice. Just, you know, like your brother, like anybody. I mean, I can't imagine killing people like that. I mean, you know, this was the hard part of it. When you get to see what's left. I mean, looking at Germany, it was just trashed. Oh, the rubble everywhere in the cities. Unbelievable. And I had to go to, well, when I went to Frankfurt and once, I was there at a party for the 7th Army. And they were having an officer's party, and when I was driving up to where they were going to have this party, and it was dark. And out of the, well, there was nobody around. Mm-hmm. The rubble was all everywhere. There was just nothing but rubble, and you had to wind your way around. They'd gotten the rubble moved over so that they made streets. Mm-hmm. And then in the morning, people would come up out of where? You couldn't tell. Out of the holes that they'd made underneath was where they were all the Germans were living, if there were any, whoever survived. Mm-hmm. And they'd come up and move around. And I've got pictures of little kids playing on these piles of rubble. And mm-hmm. Oh, gee. I'm very glad I had this experience. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, I think for the boys that, well, we did what we could, and it was more that we got out of it, what we got out of it than what they did, probably. Mm-hmm. Although I know there were some Red Cross girls that were sent over to France with the boys that went from England over the North Sea. Mm-hmm. In the invasion, there was a club mobile or two that went over on the invasion on boats, and there were some girls who were killed. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they during the war, they really were on the line, some of them. And that's why I wanted club mobile too, because I wanted to get right up close, you know. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be in on all the action.